Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick, and we continue with our expectations series tonight. We're going to talk about two young players, Elijah Surratt and Robert Longerbeam, kind of a forgotten cornerback. Joining me to do that is our good friend Gordon McGinnis. Gordon, how you doing?
I'm doing very well. Thanks for having me to be part of this.
Always a pleasure to talk football with you. Gordon was on, Gordon is a longtime employee of PFF, who recently parted ways with them and now has his own Substack. What else are you doing, Gordon? Are you looking forward to some new ventures at all with football?
Yeah, I think so. I'm going to continue to do some of my own things. I'll probably start to do a little bit more on social media, like on the video front. I've done a little bit on YouTube so far, but just haven't really had the time to get properly into it. So I definitely don't intend on going away from the football space.
All right. Well, very cool. So we're gonna talk about the Elijah Surratt first, the fourth round pick. I think we were all a little surprised that Surratt was the guy immediately after Lane was picked in round three.
Yeah, it was. And I prefer Surratt as a player to Jacoby Lane, so I was quite happy with the addition of him. But it's just one of those situations where the way the draft kind of broke down. Like, I think if the Ravens had taken Surratt in the third round, that the player that I will watch his NFL career with significant interest is Sam Hecht, the center from Kansas State, because I really liked him as a prospect. It's quite apparent the Ravens didn't, because they had numerous opportunities to draft him. So for me, I would have probably loved to have got a draft whereby it was Hecht in round three and Surratt in round four or something like that, and then they don't draft a Jacoby Lane. But Lane's obviously a very different receiver and will have a different role in the offense.
Lane is a real presence at camp, I'll tell you this. He goes up very high for the ball. He did a backflip that was pretty darn impressive after a meaningless team activity that the offense won over the defense. So it's kind of a fun guy. Really goes up high for the ball, though. Very big catch radius, you definitely notice. But anyway, Surratt, an ex-receiver, could be a big slot, I suppose, in the NFL. He could certainly do some other things. Outstanding results with fairly limited athleticism. I've noticed some things about him athletically I want to talk about, but maybe in terms of what kind of athlete he is, you want to jump in?
Yeah, he's an okay athlete is probably the best compliment you could give him. Like, his relative athletic score wasn't particularly high. I think it was like either the high sixes or the low sevens, I think, is where he came in. And he's just not, like, he's not an elite athlete, and that's not where he's going to win. I do think he is good enough at, like, the little things that you need a wide receiver to do. Like, I think he's good at the breakdown of his routes and different things like that. And that allows him to kind of get away with the fact that he doesn't necessarily have elite athleticism. And I think it's important, like, saying someone's not an elite athlete, while it is a criticism, is not the death knell on them as a player. It just means that you have to be very good at a lot of other things. There are a ton of NFL players who are not elite athletes, who are just very good technicians at a lot of different things. And I think that's probably Surratt's profile. That's not a guarantee that he turns into a great NFL player. It's just that's almost certainly his path. If he does develop into something really good in the NFL, it's going to come through the kind of technical side of things rather than just winning with pure athleticism.
Yeah, I think we definitely saw a fair amount of that. A 460, 40, you start with. He doesn't have exceptional length either. He's 31 and just a little bit in terms of arms. But his receiving metrics in Indiana have a very interesting thing. First of all, he's gone up in class basically every year that he's been through college from more humble beginnings elsewhere. But 9.5 yards per target, 2.39 yards per route run. There's nothing wrong with that. Contested catches. Now, he was in the fourth percentile of this group. 34.5% of his balls were contested. And last year, he only caught 40% of those balls. And he's had a better career record that. It's 57.4% career. But to have 40% of your balls caught on 34.5% of your targets is a pretty significant, that's 20% of the balls that you're already disqualified from catching. You know, 60% of 34.5%. Yeah. That's too much. But even despite that, he still had a QBR throwing to him of 132.9 last year. and 141.9 for his college career, which is just outstanding.
Yeah, the touchdown production played a big part in that. He had, what, 30, I don't know, 30-something, I think it
44
was.
44 and 44. 44,
there we go. Yeah.
That's so Lamar Jackson season.
Yeah. So, yeah, just really productive in the college level. Like, again, not at the elite level, but consistently. I need to look at the exact numbers. I'm pretty certain he was above 2.00 yards per route run, like, every season.
All 4 years.
Which is great. Like, that's a guy who – there's a lot of guys who don't get that involved early on. But a guy who's that consistent throughout his college career, I think there is something in that in a guy who can potentially develop in the NFL.
All right. And he played at St. Francis of Pennsylvania. That's where he started, but just not to leave this out there. And then James Madison for a year. But a big uptick in his awards and everything every year. An FCS All-American at St. Francis as a freshman, a first team All-Sun Belt as a sophomore, a third team All Big Ten as a junior, and a second team All Big Ten as a senior. So there was every time people put up new hurdles, they didn't think he could overcome them. He certainly outperformed expectation each time. And all that time, certainly lots of production as a receiver. Also, I thought a high effort run blocker, a guy who wants to, do well on a football field.
Yeah, I think, again, probably speaks to, he seems like he's a smart guy. So I think he probably understands that where he is an athlete, he has to be able to do those things. And I saw people getting upset because Kyle Shanahan was talking about Stribling, their first draft pick, being a guy who was going to block downfield for them. And everyone's getting upset because you've taken a wide receiver and the thing you're talking about is blocking. But there are a lot of NFL teams whereby you have to earn your opportunities by showing that you're willing to do the stuff. You know, the wide receivers with the most targets in the NFL are not being targeted on more than half of their plays. So it matters what you do on those other plays. Like, and a handful of, a smaller percentage of those are going to be run blocking plays. But even just when other receivers get the ball, like, do you only care about winning your route and at the end of that it's over? Or are you looking to go and block and spring a guy? Because all those little things just add up a little bit, and coaches love to see those side things.
Even Puka Nacua, I think he played over 800 snaps, but he had 200 targets to lead all of the NFL last year. Yeah. So it's 25%. So it's not very much. What else is there to say about him? I mean, as a receiver, one of the things I've noticed about him in camp, kind of a difference between Lane is more of a herky jerky turn the corner guy, obviously a big receiver in the case, but more hip sync to him, more you really notice him just running around cones in this case, because they're not even running around other players yet. This is just an individual drills and running around the cones. I notice a guy who doesn't really give away too much as he's cornering. It's a kind of a lot of efficiency of hip sync. Doesn't sink more than he needs to. The herky jerky guys, they over sync because they don't tend to be great decelerators, and then they overcorrect by trying to spring back in the other direction. I just like that a lot better. Surratt seems to be very, very good in terms of breaking off with a step. He's not Zay Flowers. Nobody is, but there's other players for a big receiver at 6'2", 210. I think he corners very well.
Yeah. I'm really intrigued to see how he does in the NFL from like a separation perspective, because I think Rashad Bateman obviously is very, very good at getting separation. It just hasn't led to a ton of production in the NFL yet. And Bateman's a higher level athlete than Surratt is, just on the basic numbers. I do think there are similarities in kind of how they conduct themselves through those routes. And I do wonder if Surratt is going to be a guy who kind of outperforms where you would have expected him to be separation-wise, just because he is good at the breakdowns. Mm-hmm.
He really needs to do that. That needs to be part of his game, given who he is as an athlete. And I think one of the things that's been projected to the NFL level is that he should really benefit from Lamar Jackson's inducing of zone defense. And the Ravens have a bunch of field stressing assets. You know, in Bateman, in Flowers, Lane is a, you know, a fast guy who probably will command island coverage to start, but they'll have other guys on the field who can generate a lot of reduced traffic areas, and against zone defense, that could really be a place where Surratt see some more opportunity with Jackson.
Yeah, and that's like Lamar wins in the middle of the field, and not only does Lamar win in the middle of the field, but I think the new offensive coordinator coming in, Declan Doyle, I think wants to win over the middle of the field as well. So I think there's a lot of stuff that will allow Surratt, provided he gets on the field, to be able to kind of win over the middle. And everything you said there, like the defense thing. I saw a discussion on Twitter the other day with someone got angry about
someone on Twitter got angry.
I don't think they're that angry, but I think it was Max Toscana, the guy who does a lot of work around like tight ends and things like that. And he was taking umbrage with the fact that a SEC head coach had referred to Lenore Sellers, I think it was, as like a mismatch for the opposing defense. And Theo Ash was kind of like going back and forth with him, trying to explain or trying to point out, like, from his perspective, that like players like that who are dual threats and genuine dual threats that can take off and cause you significant pain on any down as a runner while being able to throw the football very well. Those players are mismatches for every defense, because so many defenses in football, even if you have a good athlete at quarterback, you might have a handful of your players who have a responsibility for the quarterback on that play. When you get to the level of athlete like a Lamar Jackson, every player on defense has to be aware of what he's going to do. You know, if they're playing man defense and you go and follow a guy downfield, well, all of a sudden Lamar has a lane and he can go. So that stresses everything over that way. If you're in zone, yes, you're in zone, and yes, you're in a spot, but where's Lamar and what's he trying to do? And I think people often think about speed in terms of stress and the length of a defense, like vertically. I think it's so much more important that speed can stress a defense horizontally. Like, that's just, it opens up so much. And so much of Lamar's success in the NFL so far has been throwing the ball across the middle. And it's because he's good at throwing the ball across the middle, but it's also because he gets more open looks across the middle, because defenses can't play him the same way they can play a lot of other quarterbacks. And I think that can benefit Surratt if he gets on the field.
Yeah, very, very much true. By the way, what you're talking about in terms of putting horizontal stress on a defense, that's the Greg Roman philosophy. I mean, Greg Roman, you know, obviously was there for four of Lamar's years. I think that's right, right? I think he was there until 2019. Yeah, he was there for actually more than that. 2018 to 22, I believe he was still with the Ravens, but he wasn't in an offensive coordinator capacity in 18.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he's all about, you know, using that mesh point and using Lamar's gifts to stress the defense with multiple ways they move themselves out of position so Lamar can take advantage of it. And that was, you know, I think he's greatly underrated, but the horizontal stretching stress that they apply to the defense is never quite the same with Monken, who I think is more of a vertical stretcher of the field. Probably better in aggregate, but not as much, you know, horizontally. What else did I want to talk about here? One thing with Surratt that I think he maybe loses an opportunity to do a little bit is to make back shoulder throws, in an offense that includes Jackson. And what are you seeing that as a concern?
I think like, it's just not, it's not something we see a lot of. And I worry a little bit in general about his ability as a back shoulder guy at the NFL level, just size and athleticism. You know, like, it's more of a factor. It's not, you can be a back shoulder guy in the NFL without having huge height and huge athletic skills. But I think it definitely helps. And you're going up against better athletes, you know, especially if you're trying to catch in the back shoulder on the sideline or in the end zone, going up against the cornerback. The level of cornerback you're going up against is better. So his athleticism, I think, hurts him there as well. And yet it's just not something we see Lamar throw a lot. I do. I'm fascinated by the prospect of where Surratt actually lines up, because I don't know that it will be in a role that would see him getting a lot of those back shoulder throws anyway.
Mm-hmm. You think he's more likely then to line up in the slot than on the outside?
I think so. I really want to see how the offense is going to line up, because like Zay Flowers, I think, is going to get like roughly half of Zay Flowers' production last year, I think, came from the slot. Like, not quite exactly half, but in that range. And I think they'll continue to do that. Like, it's the Detroit Lions offense where, you know, Ben Johnson came from. And I think some of those things have been passed on to Declan Doyle. I'd need to look up the slot percentage for the Bears last year. But like that general thing there, they have no problem with your leading target getter being a guy who lines up in the slot a lot of the time. So it wouldn't surprise me to see Zay Flowers be a guy who's in the slot 60-odd percent of the time next year. But even then, with the amount of emphasis on players in the slot and targets from the slot, I think there's still going to be an opportunity for someone to be a backup there. And I think that's where Surratt can potentially thrive. And they're still going to move Flowers around. Like, he's not... I think he might play more in the slot, but he will not be exclusively a slot guy. He's too good to be limited to that role.
Okay, I have 33.9% of the time spent in the slot for Zay, yeah, as opposed to outside. But he had more production, you're saying?
More production, there. Yeah, I think so.
All right, well, let's jump right into it with what a good season looks like for Surratt, and you can go ahead and start us off.
Yeah, so when I was looking at this, I was effectively thinking about that role where most of his production comes as being like a backup in the slot. I think like a good season for him is in the range of 30 catches, like 350 yards and a couple of touchdowns. I think that's a good season for him as a rookie. Like he doesn't need to go beyond that for it to be like, oh, that's a season that is effectively a building block. I think is probably a good way to look at it.
All right, I think that would be outstanding. I try and leave it at the 60th and 80th percentile, and there's a chance. I mean, first of all, there's if you're looking at it as a bar going across here, there's a bunch of the left side of that bar is lost to health concerns, yeah. And then you have more where the guy just never really gets the playing time. You kind of hope he will. And at the 60th percentile, I see him active for 10 plus games. I think Surratt's actually going to struggle for activations potentially. He's to prove he's a good special teams player. And then he's got to beat out players like Walker and Lane on a regular basis, where I'm not sure it's going to be that easy. LaJonte Wester, I assume he's always going to be active on a week-to-week basis. And then you could have somebody like Bateman traded, I guess, that would change the nature of things. It's unlikely, it seems, because it's a cap hit for doing it. So, you know, Surratt's going to struggle to get a lot of playing time is my feeling about it. I think he'll contribute as a four-unit special teams player when he's active. At least that would be a good season if he did it. His route running and his willingness to go up for the football, I think, should show up. I don't have any particular expectation of profit, but production, but I would expect 10 to 20 targets. You know, so that's obviously less catches than that. You know, hopefully 13, 14 catches would be a reasonable number. I think he remains part of the Ravens developmental plan in a way similar to Tez Walker. If you look at how he, you know, was on the field in his first year, it was, you know, low, and they're both fourth round draft picks. Tez Walker got what, one completion for the 20 yard touchdown as a rookie at the Giants, I think.
Yeah.
So it could be pretty low, and it wouldn't necessarily be a death knell to his career. No. But
yeah. Walker, just on touching on Walker quickly, I think I was thinking about this recently. I think he probably has the biggest delta between his floor and ceiling of any Ravens player this season. Mm-hmm. Like the ceiling is that this offense theoretically will pass the ball more than they did last year. Just given the tree that Doyle comes from. If that happens, there's more opportunities. Tez Walker, you know, on the upper side of things, could wind up being the number three, maybe even the number two receiver, depending on what happens with Bateman in this offense. He could also be the wide receiver five and just ahead of Wester, who gets elevated for special teams reasons because he gets overtaken by or even six if he gets overtaken by both Surratt and Lane. So I think that's a fascinating thing to watch in the summer as well.
So handicap this for me right now. We all three of these guys are now competing effectively for that number three role. Let's assume that Bateman and Zay get the two most targets on the team. Actually, that might be a stretch with Bateman. We don't really know. But let's say among those three guys, handicap me order of targets, who will be one, two, and three. But you know who I'm talking about. But Surratt and Lane and Walker.
I think Surratt will get the most targets there. I just think he's going to impress because of the little things he does. And I think that's going to fit with what Doyle wants the offense to look like. Provided he does what I expect him to do in training camp and in preseason. Like, maybe it won't look as good as I think it will, but if he can impress with how he separates and how he does the little things well, I think there will be an opportunity for him to step up and do that, because I think that's possibly been some of the issue for Tez Walker. Is I feel like he didn't necessarily mesh with what the coaches were looking for. And again, maybe that'll be different. Maybe in this new offense, I was looking at what the Lions offense looked like. And you had Jameson Williams as the field stretcher. I could see a world whereby Tez Walker they want to utilize as like a field stretcher, and that leads to him being the number three guy, and he steps up there. But I was a lot higher on Surratt than him being a fourth round pick, and it really wouldn't surprise me if he winds up elevating himself in preseason.
I look back at my notes. I had him as a three. I said I'd be happy to get him at number 80, and they got Lane there, who I also had lower on the board. He was my 18th wide receiver. I've liked what I've seen from Lane a little more since then. I mean, not more than Surratt necessarily, but I think there are two factors that are heavily in Walker's favor for taking on a big role this year. Number one is that he's the best athlete of the group still. He's still by far the fastest of those three players. And that probably is going to make a difference. And the Ravens want a legitimate vertical threat, I think. And he's really the guy, more so than Zay, more so than Bateman, who has some, you know, the route running ability. He's really the guy on the Ravens who brings that. And then I think the second thing, which is really important, is the Ravens need to find out, and for fiscal reasons, what they have with Tez Walker. He could be very valuable. And if they never figure it out, and he goes through, plays a fourth season, you know, 26 receptions even, and you know, gets 14 receptions this year or whatever on a slightly increased target share, maintains some of the outrageous numbers he's had for ADOT and average reception and you know, ability to make plays downfield. Well, they'll have lost a big opportunity, and if they can, you know, it could be the opportunity could be as much as letting him go and getting a high round draft pick in compensatorily, but it could also be that they'll just miss out on 2 years of production from a you know, a high end athlete. I agree with you on the Delta though. I think there's a really substantial chance, and there are reasons why. Hey, you'd rather have a first year player than a third year player break out. That's absolutely true. I just don't. I think they would miss the opportunity with Walker to find out what they have, and yeah, you take a chance with in either case with the two guys.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. Let's see. Did we talk about great yet, or do we? Yeah. Let's.
No,
let's,
I don't. Okay. Yeah. So great. I mean, I would probably just increase those numbers and inflate those numbers a little bit. Like, I think a great season for him is 50 catches. You know, okay. 500-600 yards, 5-6 touchdowns, and that probably means that either Bateman's been hurt and has missed some time, or Bateman is no longer on the roster, or just that he is able to really force his way into the offense probably in the second half of the year. I don't think it's going to be like an immediate thing if that happens. But I think great for him would be all the little things he does well translate at the NFL level, and by the second half of the NFL season, he is Lamar Jackson's second favorite target among wide receivers. And I, you know, it's, maybe that's an excellent season rather than a great season, but
For me, it's above the 80th percentile, but I buy it. And I think your path to it is not unreasonable. Particularly, you know, having people fall down amongst him is also something that can buoy a player sometimes. And Surratt, you know, seems to be the kind of guy who's taken advantage of these opportunities in the past. He's very reliable as a receiver, extremely reliable. And he had that all of his college career. But I had active for 13 plus games, four unit special teams contributor, demonstrates the want to as a run blocker that earns him 300 plus snaps, including significant cross section of run and pass downs. Not an obvious guy you want on the field on an obvious passing down. I'll explain why. Because he's a guy who's going to be more likely to beat zone than man coverages, and the tendency is to play more man coverages on third and medium kind of downs. He won't be an obvious first down target on that, but hopefully he earns that cross section with the Ravens with good play, and then he gets on for more total passing snaps and more opportunities that accrue from that. But even if it's early down passing opportunities, he could be the guy. I heard you talk about the season, and I'm thinking, well, Nelson Aguilar essentially did what you're talking about a couple of years ago. And that would be a great, yeah. I guess it's 3 years now, so that would be a great one. One more thing is that he becomes a reliable target for Jackson, who beats zone coverage effectively with the Ravens' other weapons stretching defenses. Plan for 2027 usage increases despite a crowded and young wide receiver room. So, you know, they probably will draft somebody else next year. We don't know, but they well might. And it could be Zay's last year as a Raven. We'll see how that plays out in terms of a contract. Whether or not it is probably has a lot to do with how these young receivers develop this year. So that'll be another thing the Ravens probably need to look to do.
Yeah. Yeah. They're definitely going to want to see, because regardless of the Zay Flowers situation, the Ravens don't have another reliable wide receiver, right? Like, I really like Rashad Bateman. I love a lot of what he does. He just hasn't been consistent for the Ravens. So there's not, like, if Zay Flowers went down tomorrow, literally just coming to this as I'm thinking about this, Zay Flowers is probably up there with the most important players on the Ravens roster outside of Lamar Jackson, because if they don't have Zay Flowers, I don't know that they have a wide receiver that scares opposing defenses at this point in time. So that's a situation whereby they need to see if someone's going to step up and be that guy opposite Zay, or to be able to supplement some of that stuff if Zay Flowers does go away. And if not, even if Zay Flowers is staying, then they're probably still looking at spending a day two pick on a wide receiver.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp.com. For some, summer is their favorite season. Travel picks up, kids are out of school, and adventure is the focus. For others, juggling it all can be tough, can make you feel overwhelmed, and can make you count down the minutes until the kids are back in school. I know I look forward to summer as a time to take a break, but as a self-employed person, time spent away from my work is time I stress over wasting. That's where BetterHelp comes in. BetterHelp is a quality therapist who work according to a strict code of conduct and are fully licensed in the U.S. BetterHelp does the initial therapist matching for you so you can focus on your therapy goals. A short questionnaire helps identify your needs and preferences, and their 12 plus years of experience and industry-leading match fulfillment rate means they typically get it right on the first time. If you aren't happy with your match, switch to a different therapist at any time. With over 30,000 therapists, BetterHelp is the world's largest online therapy platform, having served over 6 million people globally, and it works. With an average rating of 4.9 out of 5 for a live session, based on 1.7 million client reviews. You don't have to say yes to everything this summer. Find support in therapy. Sign up and get 10% off at betterhelp.com. That's betterhelp.com.
None of these guys show anything this year.
Yeah. Yeah. They've got to know something. And it is the importance. It's so hard in the NFL. It's always a balancing act between now and the future. You know, one thing got brought up on my radio appearance the other day was, you know, how about Stephon Diggs? Do you want the Ravens to get him? I'm completely against that, largely for developmental reasons. Would Stephon Diggs be a little bit better this year than what they otherwise could have? All in balance, yes. I mean, he's an older player. You're bringing him in, it'd be, you know, a little bit better. Well, it'd be somewhat better than bringing in DeAndre Hopkins last year, who was pretty good, frankly, in the role that the Ravens cast for him. But, you know, you set back three receivers in doing it, and all of them lose snaps to an older Stephon Diggs in doing so. And I'm not in favor of that kind of a thing. And also, you know, there is a cap cost to it.
Yeah, the situations where I would be in favor of a move like that is, say, Flowers gets hurt and he's going to miss significant time, or you see something in preseason that tells you that you're really worried about any of these other guys being able to contribute anything meaningful. Other than that, if you feel even remotely okay with it, then I just think you are just you're probably hampering the development of all, if not some of those guys.
All right. Let's move on and talk about Robert Longerbeam. Obviously, lost his rookie year. Came out round six last year out of Rutgers. Was the Ravens. I think he was the second cornerback taken. They took Kone first, if I recall correctly, and then Longerbeam. And lost the entire season with a torn patellar tendon during training camp. And as this was going on, one of the things that was very, very noticeable was that Harbaugh could not really talk about the injury, or maybe they didn't know the extent of the injury initially when it happened. And he seemed to be frustrated progressively with the fact that Longerbeam could not make it back to the field. And then, you know, obviously he had surgery and to fix this problem, but really starting over again in year two, and frustrating to lose a developmental year, frustrating to use an actual year of play. But did have a big pick on Tuesday, the only interception of practice.
I saw that on social media. It's really tough for him just because you're losing, you've lost that initial developmental year, and there's a new coaching staff coming in. So I think it's hard for anyone. Like, a lot of the discussion around, you know, Emory Jones at guard, and, you know, he was a third round pick a year ago, and, you know, he played a little bit. Like, it's a new coaching staff coming in, so there's not the same loyalty to players that they were part of drafting. Robert Longerbeam, not only is he that, but there's nothing for the coaching staff to look back on and look, if they're looking back over film from last year, and say, this is what we think, how he's going to fit in there. And it's also just a very crowded room that he comes back into. So I think it's that injury is the type of thing that could really be devastating for his career, if not just his career in Baltimore, I think.
They need to sift through, obviously, a lot of very young talent at cornerback. And just to go through this, I mean, TJ Tampa, is he the Ravens' fourth cornerback at this point? I'm not sure. He played a little bit last year, played, I thought, okay. You know, he'd be a guy they could bring. He could be a guy who moves to safety. That would be a possibility. They have Marquise Robinson, played the entire year on the practice squad. He looked fantastic in the preseason. I mean, he's a guy I would really love to see get a bigger opportunity. If Kone, who's back, and he looked great in the preseason and very limited duty last year, got hurt actually against the Colts, but in camp in particular, he looked very good. And long corner, Longerbeam is a 439 guy last year, a little bit of a smallish guy at 175. He's 5'11", but he's only 175. He also turned 25 already in January. So he wasn't a young corner to start with. And now he's, you know, a second year player at age 25 is not exactly ideal. And I'm missing somebody else. Oh yeah, Rivers, who they just drafted. You know, a guy I'm sure they have high hopes for. And as you mentioned, he's this coaching staff's choice.
Yeah, exactly. It's tough as well. Like, I think his athleticism, when I was looking in at the numbers again today, he's more of like a long speed guy, like through the numbers. So he ran, was 90th percentile, I think, in 40 yard dash time, but I think he was only like 70th percentile in the 10 and 20 yard splits. Mm-hmm. And I do worry about that a little bit, given like a defense that may rely on zone coverage, in terms of like trying to cover shorter areas. But it is just, it's the, when you look at who he has to get ahead of in the depth chart to make this roster, it's really tough.
Yeah, I agree with you completely. And I looked that interception on Tuesday, my immediate thought was, boy, if there's anybody on this field who needed an interception more, yeah. I'm not sure who it was. Who could, it could mean more too. I mean, he needs to make some plays this summer, no doubt about it, to earn the attention that I'm sure he wants. You mentioned the long speed. No doubt about it is a problem. But one question about it is he going to play inside or outside? And he does have the three cone, I think, to play that slot role. He had excellent three cone among his other things. Not a good shuttle, which is interesting, kind of a diversity there, or a dichotomy, that he's a better three cone guy. But it's interesting. My feelings are well known on this, but corners avoid three cone testing. Now, like, you wouldn't believe, nobody wants to do that drill because it's a kiss of death if you don't have that that change of direction ability. But even if you do have fantastic speed,
yeah, I mean, I think there are drills at every position now. It's becoming players are opting out of them, and we're losing a lot of that. But you're right, the three cone at cornerback is just, players are avoiding it for they don't want it to be a disqualifier effectively.
Now, when you look at, you obviously you look at a lot of athletic testing and combine numbers and something, like, I think an interesting thing to do would be look at the guys who tested everything. And a lot of them, they maybe don't care. They really are told by their agents, go ahead, test in the 40th percentile things or the 30th percentile. It doesn't really matter. What shows is, you know, you wanted to compete at it, and that in itself is a positive thing. And I look at it and I say, first of all, I do like the guys who tested everything. And then I look at guys who don't test at something. And then my assumption is that their number for their position wouldn't be particularly good at the best. That it wouldn't be more than a 40th percentile. And then I look at the 35s again, you know, that you see on, what's the site? NFL Draft Buzz, I think it is, has the percentile rankings for the various things. And I think, you know, a 35 is not terrible. It's not ideal by any stretch, but he didn't embarrass himself in this drill. The guy who didn't do it at all, I'm more curious as to the reasons.
Yeah. And I think that's, I'd love to look at the numbers and see of the players who opt out of any number of drills, are they projected first and second round draft picks? At which point, like, you've got a lot to lose by having a disqualifier with some of your athletic testing. Whereas if you're a guy who is a day three guy and you know you're projected to go day three, if you can put forward two good drills, and then the rest, you just show that you're going to work and you're going to do everything, that probably does matter more to coaches. Like, coaches at that point would probably be more concerned about a guy who isn't working, because just naturally, if you're coming into the NFL as a day three draft pick, you're going to have to be a hard worker. Like, you're going to have to be willing to do things that don't always look great. It'll be interesting to see how the actual breakdown is on those things.
Yeah, and as we go through the draft and we watch the board run out on day three, I mean, you're left with, every single player has warts. I mean, it's not really concerned about what makes him an unattractive prospect. It's about what's remaining that you still like about the guy that could be good. And oftentimes, hardworking is one of the things that I think teams look for. Team captain at Rutgers, two-time honorable mention in the Big Ten, and a four-time all-academic Big Ten, which I do think is important. And I don't know what happened last year. Obviously, he was on IR, but I don't know what happened in terms of his classroom time last year. And I think that would be an interesting kind of a way to look back. Now, he may have lost whatever kind of credibility or brownie points or Scooby-Doo bonus points or whatever they are that he earned during last year's rooms. But I would hope that he was good in that setting.
Yeah, you would hope so. And you would, again, a day three draft pick, you would hope understands that his best route to the field the following year is to be ready. It's just unfortunate for him that, you know, not all of his studying will be a waste, but he's going to have to learn a lot of the new thing because there's a new coaching staff coming in.
Yeah. Has very real ball skills. 13 passes defense, led the Big Ten in 2024. He had 42. Those included 5 interceptions. I think it was 37-5. And I always get a little confused because the statistics are done differently in college, but the official statistics, passes defense are in addition to interceptions, and the official statistics for the NFL, passes defense include interceptions. And so 42, though, in 53 college games, a fantastic total.
Yeah, I think he has, like, good, like, while he isn't perfect as an athlete, I do think his, like, from reading up his scouting reports, I think that his, like, start-stop ability was pretty highly praised and was good at being able to break on routes and go and find the ball. And that's another thing that I think is an important trait if you're to stick in the slot in the NFL. Like, get a slot role in the NFL, you will see a lot of targets coming your way. A lot of those targets are going to be within 7-8 yards of the line of scrimmage. And your job is to, one, be in position to make sure no one's getting beyond that point when they're making the catch, but also, can you get a hand in there to force incompletions? And that's the type of thing that if he can do that throughout the summer and into preseason, then maybe there is more of a path than I'm giving him credit for.
198 college targets, and it looks like he had 42. So it's kind of it's always a kind of a magic threshold for corners if they can get over 20%. The standard for top draftable safeties is higher, but at corner, anything over 20% is really very good in terms of the percentage of PDs over targets. You know, when I looked at his interceptions from college, there's a mix of zone and man interceptions there. So it's not all some, he's breaking on the ball from behind. He is making plays in man coverage. I like to see that. I like to see, you know, a guy, I don't even mind. Well, okay. I don't mind. I probably like it, even if there's a little bit of diversity into some garbage pickup from tipped balls and whatnot. What I did, one thing I didn't see was him taking the ball away from somebody else's assignment, but nice mix of interceptions.
Yeah, I think that the one thing you didn't see there is probably the little bit of a concern I have is, like, is he strong enough at the NFL level? Not just for ripping the ball away, but like when it comes to things like run support and tackling and different things like that. For someone who is on the lighter side, I think you have to be quite tough. Like Nate Wiggins is very small and slight for a corner.
Yeah,
I think Nate Wiggins thinks he is double the weight that he is with the way he sometimes plays, and it's got him into some trouble at times, and he's missed some plays, I think, because he goes in a little bit recklessly and thinks he has a lot more mass behind him when he's trying to do those things. Longer beam, I would like to see a bit more toughness in kind of how he attacks players.
Yeah, I do see second man skills there, second man of the ball skills. He had 5 forced fumbles and recovered 2. I don't want to put him in the Marlon Humphrey class because Marlon was kind of a dude of his own, especially the one year. But he does have a good club action that he applies to the ball at the catch point that I've appreciated seeing. Also, he split a lot of his time between left corner and right corner. He didn't really play too much slot at Rutgers, but it tells me that he was probably dealing with the opponent's top receiver. I would guess, since I expect he was Rutgers' top corner at the time, and I don't remember actually who he was playing with. But if he splits within a game, like game to game, somebody, you move left corner to right corner due to injury or something, that happens a lot. But when you have a lot of left and right corner lineups during an individual game, that usually means there's traveling involved. And it probably meant he was on the rifle butt end of that, getting a lot of number one receivers because of who he is.
Yeah. I think I just as you're talking there, I'm going to look it up and see if see if he was. But I'm pretty sure he was their top cornerback. I can't remember anyone else. And I feel like he was rated a little bit higher by most people than going in the sixth round. Like I think not that anyone thought he was like one of the top steals in the draft, but I feel like people felt the value the Ravens got from him. In the sixth round was solid enough. Looking at, they had Sierra Wright, but I'm pretty confident from this that he was in fact the number one corner.
Right. So the place where he would have got dinged is in coverage snaps per target, where he's at 6.35, and that's kind of being targeted a lot as a corner. It's in the 25th percentile. But his yards per target were excellent, 6.6. His OPR was 73.3. That's you know, very good. He did have some penalties in college, and he gave up some yak, which wasn't particularly good. And he had some missed tackles. So you know, there were some things that weren't perfect about his record. But I did think that it probably was a function of in some of these metrics of who he was facing.
Yeah. I was looking at Nebraska instead of Rutgers, but the same is true. I don't think there's anyone there who would have been above that. So,
all right, the hopeful comp, maybe a Tavon Young was approximately the same size. Tavon is actually a little bit shorter and maybe a little bit more compact and thicker than longer beam is. Longer beam is more like a twig.
Yeah, he's a thinner guy. That's probably not a bad hopeful comp if things go well.
What else we got? We talked about the interception he had the other day. Let's get into a good season. What does a good season look like?
So this is very different from the Elijah Surratt one, where I think my good season was actually like quite high percentile. I think a good season is simply makes the final 53. it's just there's a lot of players ahead. Like, even if it's in the slot role, like, as long as Marlon Humphrey's on that roster, he's ahead there. Kyle Hamilton's going to play a good number of snaps in the slot. Keon Martin, again, it's not a coaching staff. It's not the same coaching staff, so there's maybe not the same loyalty to an undrafted free agent, but came in, did a solid job for the Ravens last year. And then you just look around the rest of the room, like, how easy is it for him? For a guy of his size, if he's not going to be able to crack the room in the slot, then how easy is it for him to then get ahead of some of the other guys? I also think, like, Chandler Rivers is a guy who I think might get some looks in the slot, given how he plays. So, yeah, good season for me is genuinely just he makes this final roster. I think that would have meant a very nice summer and preseason for him.
Okay, I couldn't go quite that high. And my reason is I have to ask myself the question again at the 60th percentile. Is there a 40% chance of him making the team? I don't think it's that high, unfortunately. So I said plays well in camp and preseason, but is relegated to the practice squad by a crowded CB room searching for youth. He's beaten out by three of Kone, Martin, Rivers, Robinson, and Tampa. So then that would give them six corners, you know, with Owusie, Humphrey, and Wiggins, such that they wouldn't have a spot for him. But that still could mean he's elevated as needed with no expectation that he makes the 53, and his speed, no reason that he's ever permanently elevated to the 53, and his speed makes him a 90-man candidate again in 2027. But frankly, at age 26 next year, the window will be closing. His time is right now. He needs to impress right now. And that's why the interception Tuesday, I think, was so important.
Yeah, I agree.
All right, how about a great season?
Great season for me is, like, actually plays and is somewhat effective. Like, if he winds up being on the field for 50 to 100 snaps, then I think that's a great season for him, because it means that not only has he made the final roster, but either through liking him as a player or trusting him when other players have got hurt, he's seen a little bit of the field. It's really, really tough to see a huge amount. Yeah.
What you've described is more than just mop-up play. He'd have to actually play rotationally, which would be very good. It might mean starting a Week 18 game that doesn't mean anything, which would still be good because it means they're interested in what his future is. But to me, it's for a great season. Stays healthy in preseason, plays well enough to take no worse than the fifth cornerback spot on the 53. For that, he needs to beat out three of Kone, Martin, Rivers, and Tampa. It's possible. Tampa would basically have to maybe move to safety or I'm not sure. Tampa just does not have the speed that the other guys have. But I'll give you one little anecdote from camp the other day. They had a drill where they had to hit a sled. It was a one-man sled. It was just the cornerbacks doing it, and then shed the sled and go out. And the force that Tampa applied to that sled was really impressive. He forklifted the sled up and then he threw it to the side. And he goes, it's very different looking from everybody else. Rivers, smaller guy, puts in a good effort, but just doesn't move the sled all that much. And there were some other guys I'm not sure if it was a case of effort or a case of size, but they were just not up to the thing. But Tampa, man, he is a beast in terms of moving things like that.
I do think Tampa, weirdly, without any real evidence behind this, he strikes me as a guy who Jesse Minter will probably really like. Like, I think he is a better fit as his own corner. And Jesse Minter doesn't necessarily need elite cornerbacks to make his defense work, but he has good size, plays well in zone, and has that kind of toughness. Good at forced incompletions as well. Good at forcing those things. So, like, he's probably the guy in the defensive backfield that if someone's going to make a big leap this year, I think he probably has a sneaky chance of being that guy.
Yeah, it's sad that his career seems to have gotten boiled down to that one number, which is 459 in the 40. You can live at 450 in the 40 and you're known as not having elite speed, but every 0.01 thereafter is a pretty significant ding to your chance to be an effective NFL cornerback. And a lot of guys just end up moving to safety at that point. One of them was Daryl Worley was a guy who had a long and okay career at corner after being moved off safety effectively because of being moved off corner because of a time that just wasn't very good. So I still think Tampa could make it there, and I'm not ruling out the possibility that he could be at corner. I'm just not sure that on this team, I'm not sure they do it. And one of the possibilities is they go with a hybrid guy. And Tampa's that guy, or Humphrey's that guy for that matter. And they really go with five corners and effectively, four and a half, we'll call it four and a half safeties and five and a half corners. Because they're very safety heavy as a defense anyway. And you want to make sure you have, one extra guy for sure, but really two to cover the possibility that Hamilton does not have to, out of necessity, move off the front end, move out of that slot corner role.
Yes, exactly.
All right, a little more here, and it's not much, but I think he'll be a solid special teams performer, a great season with his speed and an improvement in tackling, including a role on the kickoff unit. And he gets a limited trial, less than 100 snaps on defense in 2026. So similar to you, and special teams play is solid and activations are regular by midseason, remains a part of the 2027 roster decision. So fairly modest in both our cases in terms of what a great season looks like. And I think that's honestly probably appropriate.
Yeah, we covered it at the top when we started talking about him. He has a very, very tough battle to make this roster. Just given the players around him, given the time he's lost and given the change in coaching staff. So it's great. Like, it's great that he had the interception earlier this week, because as much as I'm down on this chances of making the final roster, it would be great for the Ravens if he is in contention to make that final roster, because it means they have good, difficult decisions to make. There's two types of difficult decisions when it comes to rosters in the NFL. You're making decisions because you don't have good players at positions, or because you've got a wealth of those things. And if they wind up, the big thing for him is not even just, let's say he does perform incredibly well, but he's not going to crack the top 7-8 cornerbacks for the Ravens. Then there's a trade opportunity for him to go to another team for, a 7th-round pick, a 6th-round pick, something like that. So it's a big opportunity for him this spring and summer and into preseason to kind of make an impact for his NFL future.
I'll toss one more thing out there, and I'm not sure how longer Beam's apparent academic success translates into the position room, but I assume it's pretty well. And the guy I want to bring up is Jeremy Lucien, who's been on this show a number of times for his background. And, he started as a corner, and he was at UConn and Vanderbilt. And then he had to move to safety in the NFL. And that's not where Longer Beam is headed. But the point I'm making is that in the defensive backs room, I think it probably really helped the Ravens to have a brainy guy. And he got through his engineering degree, mechanical engineering degree. And in fact, was in his, in his graduate work when he was at Vanderbilt. And I think that really helps coaches to have a guy who's pushing the other guys who may not be paying attention, may not be focused. I don't think it has to be pure mathematical brilliance or anything like that, because I don't think that's what the game requires. Just in terms of academic focus, I think often will be something that could really help the coaches build the culture they want within each room. Sorry, you're right. Yep.
I agree with all that. Yeah, I think that all makes perfect sense.
All right. Gordon, always a pleasure to talk football with you. Very interesting, your background there. He's Gordon's in Scotland right now, and we started, and it was still light there. Now it's dark, but obviously we had a different kind of daylight. We're used to going to Alaska, maybe some places here, and you're used to seeing a midnight sun kind of thing. But we hear you get a little bit longer days.
Yeah, this time of year is nice because we do wind up getting a little bit longer. I've obviously lived all over. Like, I had my 6 weeks I lived in Cincinnati where pretty much the it didn't seem to change. Like, it, regardless of time of year, it was about 7 p.m. It kind of got dark. Same when we lived over in Dubai, it was similar. It's nice here in Scotland in the spring and summer. We've got probably like about a 2-month period now whereby it'll still be light, like 9:30, 10 p.m., kind of dusk like that. So I'm not going to complain, because when we get to winter and it's going to be dark at 4 p.m. here.
All right. Tell folks where they can find your work online.
Yeah, you'll find me. It's Gordon NFL on Twitter or X. The Substack is Ravens in Five. And same for YouTube. I'm more active on the Substack. I've got about 3 posts going out a week, just currently going through like what the Ravens roster is and going through each player there. And then building up for the season and talk more about obviously every game as it happens.
All right. All right. Outstanding stuff. Other folks, use hashtag film study mailbag if you would for questions for the show. Thanks very much for your support for it. And as always, tell that one other person. Oftentimes it's an older person who doesn't really work well with podcasts, but you can show them how to click on the play link on the website, and that might be an easier way for somebody to do it. And we've actually found that a lot of our listenership comes from exactly that. So we're actually trying to promote it more, given how many people are watching directly from Chrome. Anyway, Gordon, thanks again for coming on.
Thank you very much for having me. I just lost that mute button twice.
We'll talk to you next time on Film Study.